Hi, I'm Rabbi Menachem Wolf of the Spirit Growth Joseph Chris Center. In this talk on near-death experiences, we first explore the nature of body and soul and their relationship, and begin to delve into what happens as the soul and body begin to come apart. What's the conscious or superconscious experience that a person has? And why is it that in different traditions and cultures, people see different things? And yet there's a common thread in all of them. Could they all be right? Could they all be wrong? Does it even matter? At the end of this talk, there's a meditation which was recorded live. We hope you enjoy this recording. And if you would like to support the remastering of old talks or sponsor a new podcast, be in touch with us via our website, spiritgrow.org. And now, here's the talk.
The term near-death experience is a baby term. It's been around for maybe a few decades, more than a few decades, three, four decades. It's attributed to a chap named Dr. Raymond Moody. Now, Dr. Raymond Moody was, I believe, a psychologist in America, a physician, and he first encountered the concept of near-death experience when he was speaking to someone significantly older than him, a well-known psychiatrist. Now, I'm not going to go into it because I'm not here to give you a rundown on Dr. Moody's books, although they do exist in our library, and they are very, very interesting. But I'm really just bringing it up that this is a concept, a word, a three-word phrase that has only been around for a very short amount of time. Now, as we're going to see shortly, the idea has existed for a lot longer, but to coin the phrase near-death experience, it's a baby phrase. It's a baby phrase. So you're not going to be able to really type it into your older encyclopedias, which I don't know why they would even be digitalized if they were older, but you can't just type it and expect to get all sorts of responses from throughout the ages. There is no term for near-death experience in Hebrew. It's not a concept, as we will see shortly. Before we even touch near-death experiences, we've got to lay some groundwork. There are two types of cynics in this room. There are the cynics who come from a scientific background, and there are the cynics that come from a spiritual background. Both of you are dismissed from this discussion. Now, the reason is because, let's start with the scientific. There's been a lot of research into near-death experiences. One of the most interesting things about my research for this course was actually not from the Kabbalistic side. I enjoyed that and I loved it. But where I found fascination and new things that I just never knew was actually how much research and how many departments and how many universities in how many countries actually research near-death phenomena and near-death experiences. I didn't realize that this is not only is it not taboo or voodoo stuff, this is massive. But interestingly, it's heavily controlled. The research is usually conducted by people in the neurosciences or in the psychiatric pharmacology departments. And it seems to be rather limited in the interest to those departments. Makes sense. But with science comes a need, and that need is something that I would imagine most people in this room actually have. We all have a need, and the need is to quantify things. I'd love to meet the person, they do exist, such people, but I'd love to meet the person tonight who says, I don't need to understand, I don't need to quantify, I don't need to be able to wrap my head around things. I love when things don't fit in boxes. In fact, I wish everything didn't fit in a box. I'm happy to just be flighty with it all. It's not a common Western value, and it's definitely not something that we naturally tend to. As humans, we tend to want to box things in, because when it's in a box, we understand it. I am a male. There are females in this room. I get that. A male, we know what that means. You've got certain organs. A female, we know what that means. You've got certain organs. We like, you're old. I know what that means. You're young. I know what that means. We love a good definition. And what Western values, what Western society loves to do is ensure that everything is boxed in to a definition. So much so that there are definitions to what a near-death experience is. the masters of the laboratory, the great masters, have placed criteria on what is and what is not a near-death experience. And so the spiritualists in the room are probably sitting back, rolling their eyes like, oh, so now they're going to define what a near-death experience is, what knocking on heaven's door actually is and is not. But the truth is, everything that takes place in a lab must be quantified and qualified. That's just the nature of the lab. So if they want to research it, they place their parameters on what is and what isn't, and what they're going to do with the results. So it's very important that if you fit into that category, that you realize that I am not coming at this subject from a lab point of view, although I completely respect it. Completely respect it, because it's the lab that's going to help us siphon. And this is a highly judgmental statement. But it's the lab that will help us siphon the nutters and the people who are mad from the people who are having genuine experiences. They're not going to be able to do that job for us completely. However, with the help of medical knowledge, we are able to understand, are we dealing with someone who is of sound mind and we want to hear what is going on here? Or are we dealing with someone who is not of sound mind? And the truth is, even if someone is not of sound mind, if you look through the Talmudic and Kabbalistic teachings, that doesn't mean that there's someone that they shouldn't be heard. It's not saying that we're going to listen to every single natter who has a prophecy. If we did that, we'd be all over the show. And that's why Maimonides, and that's why the Talmud, and that's why Jewish law have actually legalized what is a prophet. What is a prophet? What is it that is prophecy? What is not prophecy? Because otherwise we're going to be taken for rides by the most charismatic, by the most interesting, by the most crazy people. So there are categories. So we've got to respect the idea of scientific qualification for things. However, that's not going to be the purpose of this series, nor the topic of tonight. Now let's talk about the spiritualists, because they also need to be at my mercy. So I've had a bit of a bash of the lab dwellers. Now for those that like to live in a temple. There are some people that like everything to be spiritual. And there are people that see angels where there are no angels, and there are people that see demons where there are no demons. Not everything is to be overly spiritualized. Not everything needs to have a deep-seated meaning and some sort of inherent meaning according to your interpretation. There are people who look for spirituality where the spirituality is not there to be interpreted, and there are people who look for deep significance where the deep significance is not actually what they interpret to be. And often this comes not from a place of deep learning, but it actually comes from the absence of learning. So let me just be, as you can see, I have a cynical, dark humor side. I'll try not to let the dark humor out, but the cynicism I can't control. But when someone says to me, oh, I know about that religion, I say, oh, how do you know about, let's say, Buddhism? I spent a month in Tibet. So, spent a month in Tibet. And you know everything that there is to know about Tibetan Buddhism. Not only that, but I'll tell you, it's not for me. It's like, you know it's not for you. It's like when people say, I know about Judaism. I often eat at my rabbi's house on Friday night. It's like, what do you know from Judaism? Or when someone says, I don't believe in God. Why? I know some religious people. I know all about God. Again, having dabbled on a Wikipedia entry and fallen asleep five times while reading it doesn't make us an expert, doesn't make us anything. And often, when we learn a little bit about a spiritual system, we love to see it everywhere. So that's not a bad thing, but it's important that we not start passing judgment or making decisions about all sorts of things based on a book, based on a teaching, based on one lecture. So even what you hear from me tonight, take it with a grain of salt. And the reason why I say that is because I am Menachem Wolf. If I misrepresent the text, I ask for forgiveness beforehand, not just from you for wasting your time, but also from the text which I quote. If you don't like what I say, it's me, it's not the text. And if you like what I say, continue learning. Don't give up at the end of this series. So that's my little preamble of the mystic versus the scientist. So let's start. What's fascinating about the near-death experience is that it has existed as long as time has been recorded. It's been around forever. It exists in all cultures, the concept of near-death experience. And what's really interesting, and I just want to record this, is that there have been, like everything in America gets surveyed, right? Everything in America gets studied. People say Aussies will bet on two flies walking up a wall. Americans will survey the people who watch the two flies. They love a good survey. With rooms for error, they've got it all. So there have been some massive surveys conducted in a scientific space regarding near-death experiences. And what I found interesting is that there is no one religious group that experiences more near-death experiences than any other religious group. There is no culture that experiences near-death experiences any more than any other culture. There is no age group or sex that experiences the near-death experience more than any other. And it is not religion-based, meaning that there was an equal spread across religion, religious people, non-religious people, non-believing people, people who lived with no spirituality or had any spiritual inkling in their life. So what's fascinating about the near-death experience, and I suppose that's why the science labs around the world and the medical hospitals around the world have all put this under the microscope, because it doesn't seem to relate to any one group, which means it's kind of interesting. This isn't spiritual quackery. This is a human experience that many people have. Not only that, but if you go to the cultures of the East, you'll get the near-death experiences. And if you get to the religions of the West and the cultures of the West, you'll get the near-death experience. If you go to ancient Egypt, you'll get the near-death experience. And if you go to 2015 Duke University Hospital, you'll get it. So what I'm trying to bring out is that this is something that has existed for a long time. But it's only in the last 40 years that in the West it's become researched and therefore it has deserved its own entry in Wikipedia. It's become its own entity. But what's interesting is that across cultures and societies, it was never a concept. There is no book in Judaism on near-death experiences. If there was, this would have been an awesome class to prepare. Sit down for two nights, read the book, regurgitate it, and you go, huh, he's a genius. But there is no near-death experience book. In fact, even in the Talmud, there is no chapter that relates to the near-death experience. There are stories that pop up here, stories that pop up there. The Zohar talks about it anecdotally as if, well, of course you know about people who have gone up and come back before their time, as if that's just normal. And likewise in other cultures and other religions of the world. In Egypt there is the Book of Death. In the East there are books of death. But you don't find the Book of Near Death. So this just makes the topic even more interesting because it seems to just cut across so nicely. Now, I'm not really going to reference in this series other religions. I may talk a little bit, but not much. And do you want to know why? Because every religion and every culture and every person that has had a near-death experience talks about very similar experiences, very similar sightings, very similar visions. They differ, and we're going to talk about tonight why they differ and how is it that a Christian has a near-death experience that is so different to a Buddhist, that is so different to a Jew, that is so different to an atheist, but as in who they see and what they see. But there seems to be a lot of talk about light, a lot of talk about dark tunnels, bridges, family or loved ones or mentors or sacred leaders welcoming them. Some will talk about a person with a book. Others will talk about a court, a heavenly court. All will speak about an out-of-body experience, an experience of detachment, an experience of higher insight and wisdom, a slowness as well as a silence. Now, here's where I put some of you on the spot. I'm not going to ask any questions after this. Is there anyone in this room that has had a near-death experience? Okay. So as we can see, people in this room have experienced it. And I promise not to ask any more questions, but I'll ask again. From the people who have had, is what I've just described, any of those aspects, the darkness, the light, the tunnel, or the bridge, the book, the people, the family, the being told to go back, any aspects, not all those aspects, are any of those aspects familiar or at all aspects of that? Okay, I've never had it, so I'm going purely on what has been recorded. And what I'm saying is that you say, oh, those are kind of general things, the light, the hissing sound, the buzzing sound, but they're actually not generalizations. There seems to be, depending on, and I'm just going to go back to the science for a moment, in the scientific writings and in the journals on near-death experiences, there is anywhere between 5 categories, 10 categories, or 15 categories. They're not actually mutually exclusive, these numbers. It's just how much they want to put into each category. So I've just described quite a few: the light, the darkness, the detachment, the floating, the buzzing or hissing sounds, the bridge, the family members or mentors or whatever, the book, the judgment, or the being told to come back. These seem to be the common things. And I'm not just going on, well, those seem to be the common things, but in our writing, all these things get discussed. And so I'd like to discuss all of those and what they are. What we know about near-death experiences in Judaism comes from different sources, or more correctly, from different experiences. There are some people who had a near-death experience in that they thought they were approaching death and they were able to experience something rather phenomenal, and then they came back and reported on it. And then you get others who are aware that they are close to death, experience it in a state of where they are both experiencing an external experience while at the same time they are anchored in their body. Let me give you an example. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is one of the greatest sages in Jewish history. He pops up all over the Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai died at a ripe old age. Now, this isn't quite what you'd say is a classic near-death experience, but I'm bringing it for a very precise reason. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, this story is brought in the volume of Brachot in the Talmud. So this is a Talmudic story. When he was on his deathbed, it was his last day of life, and he was frail, but we know that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was sharp until the end. The Talmud often describes the rabbis who were sharp to then. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, the author of most of the Zohar, we know was extremely clear until literally closing his eyes with a smile. It says that he closed his eyes and he smiled, and that was it. Death came. So we know when they were, it's important to know who was of sound mind. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai told his students, please prepare a chair for Chizkiyahu HaMelech, one of the kings of Israel, who had died centuries before. He says, prepare a chair, a comfortable chair, a royal chair for Chizkiyahu, for he has come to welcome me on my journey. So what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying is that I am completely aware of what is going on and I can see things, while all the other students in the room were there and they couldn't see anything. So it's these sorts of stories that give us a glimpse into what people who are experiencing the journey into the canal of death, what they are experiencing based on what they're saying right then and there. So you get some people who are reporting as they're experiencing, and then you get others who report after they've experienced. And we'll talk about that. We'll go through a few more interesting stories in our history then. But before I do, now that I'm bringing the topic of death up, it's important that you realize near-death experience, and what I love about this phrase, near-death experience, is that it cannot be misunderstood. It is not a post-death experience. It is not a death experience. It is a near-death, which means that the person has not died. Whatever's happened on the operating table is not important right now to me. It's not important for the sake of this discussion. the concept in Kabbalah of the near-death experience is an experience which someone has close to death. Now, they may already be moving beyond the body. They may not be alive, but nor are they dead yet. This is the soul in a state of exit, but it has not exited the building. Why is this important? Because the next part of this series, I'm talking about post-death experiences. And you say, Menachem, I get how you know about near-death experiences. How do you know about post-death? I've got to keep some things for later. So that's the post-death experience. But the near-death experience, the reason why I'm pointing this out is because anything we talk about now in what is experienced in the near-death experience must be understood that this is not what's going to happen to you after you die. What we're discussing here is not what we have on the other side. We're not talking about the other side. Why is that important? Because people do have near-death experiences, and they'll say, I saw this, I saw this, I saw that. But if they didn't die in that, if they woke up, then they didn't die. I'm not talking about clinically were they dead, not dead. I'm talking about spiritually. Death means that you walk through and there's no coming back. It's like reading an Enid Blyton book. I don't know if you ever read The Magic Faraway Tree. Yes? Pauline for sure read The Magic Faraway Tree. In The Magic Faraway Tree, the kids climb up a tree and they climb into a land and there's a hole in the land. And if the land blows away from the top of the tree, that hole seals up and they can't climb back down the hole onto the tree and they can't get back home. So the kids always have to be careful that that hole doesn't close up, because if it does, there's no coming back. And that's what death is. Death is a point of no return. What happens after death is a completely different thing. The soul is now soaring and flying on its next journey. That's where we discuss concepts like heaven, the Garden of Eden, the garden, Eden, hell, turmoil of the grave, all this. But that's not for now. We're going to get there sometime next week or the week after. This is what happens in that first drifting state. It's not that you have a choice whether or not to come back in the near-death experience. It's that you either don't, it's that you don't die. And for whatever reason you return, either because something has sent you back down or something has brought you back down. We'll talk about that in a moment. What do you mean something has brought me? As if there's a higher control here on earth. So let's start. I think I've got the preambles. It's a bit like the horses, the trots before they run. You know, they're in the cage. It's like, let's just get going. Enough. We understand where we're running. We know we're running. Let's just run. Patience. If we would have started this class where I wanted to start, A, we'd be finished already. B, I'd have got all excited and you'd have a million questions. And then I'd have to go systematically through everyone's questions and we'd end up here all night. First thing, I don't know who was here at the last series of last year or the second last series of last year, I don't remember. But we discussed the idea that everyone has a time to go. This wasn't the theme of the class, it popped up. I want to just elaborate on it right now. Everyone has a time at which they will go. We say it in the Yom Kippur service. We say that it's decided who will live and who will die. Who will be rich, who will be poor, who will suffer, who will be free. So we've got lots of different options. So what does that mean? We have lots of different options. Do we have a fixed amount of time of how long we're going to live? Or do we have options? And the truth is, we have both. Every single person in this room has a mission in which they're living. Everyone here is going to live life and hopefully will achieve something unique for their soul in this period called life. And you'll probably be given 80, 90, 100 years. It's a safe bet. 80, 90, 100 odd years. The thing is, we know that not everyone lives 80, 90, 100 years. Now, sometimes it's because they're not meant to get that long, and sometimes it's because their life is cut short. Now, what does it mean that their life is cut short? Now's a good time for everyone to check their phones, just to check. Lucky we're not doing meditation. We'll do that in 25 minutes. Then you'll probably get an elbow from someone. So I want to draw on a story of Chizkiah. Let's talk about David HaMelech first. David HaMelech, King David, was meant to... Don't worry. David HaMelech, King David, was meant to die at birth. It says that when Adam saw the future, he saw the soul of King David, and he saw that King David was going to be born, and he was going to die at his birth. And so Adam asked God, what's with that? This is such a powerful soul, such an incredible person, potentially. And the response, this is the Medrash. This isn't a conversation that's recorded in the Torah. This is a Medrash. This is telling us something on a much deeper level. This isn't about the discussion, but I'm sharing the discussion. And the response from God to Adam was, there is no time for him to live. All the years of time have been allotted, and there's no time for this soul, and therefore this soul will die at birth. So Adam said, give him 70 years of my life and let me die earlier. And God said, fine. Adam died at age 930, he was meant to live the full 1,000 years, and David, King David, lived exactly 70 years. Now the Talmud records that David was sitting and composing at the end of his life. And the angel of death was waiting to harvest his soul, but couldn't because King David was involved in some sort of mystical spiritual activity. And so he had to make a distraction outside, a noise outside, which would distract him from his learning momentarily. And in that moment, he was able to take his soul. And that's exactly what happened. That David was sitting and they found him dead because at that moment he had paused. So what we see is that everyone has an allotted amount of time, but the factors can change. This was a factor of had Adam not stopped, he would have lived longer. How long? I don't know, until he fell asleep. But what we can see is that everyone has an allotted amount of time, and King David literally milked the full amount of time. The famous story of Chizkiah was Chizkiah was one of the greatest kings in Jewish history. What made him a great king wasn't just that he was a great guy and a good ruler and a fair leader. What made him great was the fact that his father was an absolute rogue, criminal, horrible slave master king who enslaved the Jewish people, persecuted the Jewish people. He was a Jew, but really had it in for the Jews. And his son, Chizkiah, is this righteous, spiritual lover of all that is. Now, Chizkiah fell deathly ill, and he summoned the prophet, Yeshaya. And he said, what's going on here? Yeshaya said, say your last prayers, you're going to die within the next 3 days. So Chizkiah says, whoa, one second, where are you getting that information from? So Yeshaya says, I'm a prophet, and I can see that you're not going to live more than 3 days. So Chizkiah says, hey, you may be a prophet, but every one of the kings of the Jewish people have also been granted prophecy. And I have an instinct that I'm still meant to live some years, 15 years. So Yeshaya says, I don't know what you're talking about. The prophecy is 3 days. So Chizkiah says, can't be. So Yeshaya says to him, you know what your problem is? You think you've got it all under control. You were meant to live another 15 years. But you didn't go with what the plan for life was. And because you altered the plan, you're not needed. So Chizkiah says, what do you mean? So Yeshaya says, you're not married. You've got no children. The whole purpose of you being in this world was to bring children into this world. You haven't done it. The system doesn't need you anymore. There's an algorithm, which is what the whole last series was about. The algorithm of life. The algorithm that we're all integrated and all of us are impacting each other's lives. And he says, and you have changed the algorithm, and therefore the algorithm is now coming back to bite you. It's time for you to die. And that's why you're so deathly ill. So Chizkiah says, Yeshaya, you've got a daughter. Give me your daughter. I didn't have children because I have a prophecy that if I have a child, that child is going to be a shocking human being. And I don't want to be responsible for bringing those people into this world. Yeshaya says he can't mess with the system. So he says, give me your daughter between my righteousness and your daughter's righteousness. The chances are we'll have a good kid. Yeshaya says, nah, too late. No deal. You're meant to die. So Chizkiyahu says, one sec. There is a famous teaching that even when the sword is on the throat in an act of decapitation, even when the sword is on your throat, you are not allowed to give up hope and must continue to pray. That's a principle in Judaism. Even when we are faced with death, where the blade is on our neck, we're not allowed to give up hope. It's forbidden. So Chizkiyahu says, Yeshaya, you know what? You may be a powerful prophet, but you've broken you've gone against the fundamental teaching. And he went to the wall and he prayed. And he prayed that should he live out the next 3 days and should he recover, he will marry and have a child. Yeshayahu leaves the palace, comes running back and says, I had a prophecy. You're meant to live. Take my daughter. Lo and behold, Chizkiyahu marries Yeshayahu's daughter. He lives another 15 years and he brings one of the worst people ever in Jewish history into this world, Menasheh, one of the worst kings ever. So what we see from this story, what we brought it, that story was to do with the algorithms and time of life and death. That was all that previous series. You can go online, go onto the spiritgrow.org website, check the hub, the learning hub, the online hub. You can watch what we were talking about there. What I want to bring in here is that we actually have moments that we could die, and we may not. A near-death experience, I'm not saying is, but maybe one of those times of where it's a juncture, which point life has brought us to a point of where we're meant to die, we have an option to die, and for whatever reason, we don't die. That could be a moment of a near-death experience. Why do I say could be? Because A, who am I to know such things? Who is anyone to know such things? I've never seen what I've just said written in any absolute. It's just a concept. It's a hypothetical. Because there's another reason why we may be having a near-death experience. Because we need to have the near-death experience. Nothing to do with dying, everything to do with living. That the experience that we have is an important one for us to have in the flow of our life. Which means that there's a very important significance here as to what is it that we're seeing and for whom is that important. So recently, I don't know if you saw, it's a very popular video that's been going around over the last few months. It was a 15 or 16-year-old boy in Israel who had a near-death experience, and he saw all sorts of incredible things, and he saw a war that was going to happen, and all sorts of incredible stuff. And people said, Menachem, you believe it? You believe it? So it's not to believe or not believe. This person says that they had that experience. I don't deny that person had an experience. If you're asking me what is the implication of what he's saying, I don't know. I don't know. Because I don't know why he experienced what he experienced. Maybe he experienced it for us to hear his story. Maybe he experienced it for him to see the story. And maybe the whole thing is rubbish. And maybe the whole thing is absolute truth and we have no idea. It's not, and that's what I was saying early in the piece of tonight. It's not for us to say, oh, this is the significant meaning. This is what it's all about. Who are we? What, we're righteous sages? We've sat and meditated and reached a point of spiritual sensitivity that we know what every soul does and doesn't experience, which is what the definition of sensitivity is, the ability to detect the spiritual energy of absolutely everything, including the self, which means that the self never stumbles. That if you know someone that has never done anything wrong, that lives a spiritual life, that lives a life of abstinence, that lives a life of perfection, whose family are happy, whose community are happy with this individual, 24, that if you wake them up in the middle of the night, you will not get a nasty word. If this is a person who can speak to you about stuff that you have no idea how they know about it, not because they play some weird psychology game, but because they can cut right in and tell you who you are because they can read your soul, then you're dealing with a spiritual person. Anything short of that is a nice person. Nice, I respect them. But for someone to say what the meaning of someone else's subjective spiritual experience is, not for us. All we can do is respect it. So let's move into the soul-body relationship, because death is the soul and body parting ways. That's what death is. Life is the soul and body integrated. So in order to understand this near-death experience, in order to start moving beyond, let's understand who is it that's having the experience. So again, if you read, watch, or listen to anyone that's had a near-death experience, one of the most common things is that it's out of body. Or even if it wasn't out of body, there was a strange sense of detachment. By the way, not every near-death experience is fluffy and nice. There are many people who have had horrible near-death experiences, absolutely horrible, where there was pain and there was noise and there was suffering, but there was clarity. There's clarity. That's the commonality. Not everything is all beautiful and rosy, by the way, for everyone's experience. But it's important to understand who's having the experience. If the person is dead, then how are they experiencing? As in, if their brain isn't functioning, how are they experiencing? If they are seeing themselves, then it's not the person lying there that's having the experience. So who's experiencing? So firstly, I want to talk about the soul and body very quickly. The soul and body are two forms. I don't know if you've ever looked at yourself in the mirror. I highly recommend you do. If you ever want to have a Kabbalistic experience, just look at yourself in the mirror and you'll see the most incredible thing. The most incredible thing. The human is... I mean, the truth is, if you want to have another Kabbalistic experience, look at an animal or a tree, pretty much anything. I don't know about the plastic table. It's kind of man-made. But look at things in nature, and you will have a mystical experience. Say, why? What's so special about the body? Look at you. You've got two hands, a right hand and a left hand. You've got two eyes, a right eye and a left eye. You've got one nose, a mouth. Your head is up here. Your feet are down there. It's an incredible specimen. But that's not what makes us spiritual. It's that this design of the human is built on a blueprint, a conceptual blueprint called the Adam Ha'elyon, the higher man, Adam Kadmon, the primordial man, the original man not being Adam or anything like that, the original man being the first concept of right and left, Chesed and Gvura, kidneys, Yesod, Hoid, the Keser, the top of the head, Chochma Bina. This, if you take the Sfirot and put them in a chart, you get the shape of a person. The human body is actually just a physical art piece representing a spiritual concept that if you had spiritual eyes, you would see this image. But it's not this image, because this is images are physical, but the primordial man is this conceptually. And the soul that fits into your human body is, my soul is 6 foot. How do I know that? Because I'm 6 foot. My body is a physical manifestation of my spiritual self. My spiritual self, i.e. my soul, exists separately from my body, but it completely inhabits my body, and my body is completely enlivened by my soul. The two are one because the two come together. When the two go their ways, the soul has no form, and the body has no life. We call that death. If you've ever been to a morgue, or you've seen someone who's died, there is a difference there. They're dead. There's no life. It's flesh. You can see it's lifeless. It's lacking its vibrance. It's lifeless. And there's a soul there, but you don't see the soul. You know why? Because the soul has no form. Because the soul has no being. The soul has no physicality. The soul is not a physical concept. It is a spiritual concept that is just physical enough to have a relationship with the body, which means the body is just spiritual enough to have a relationship with the soul. The body, as in you, are this beautiful, symbiotic relationship of two existences that aren't just intertwined, but they're fused together. At death, they pull apart. So we have two bodies, our physical self and our spiritual self, which means that the spiritual self has a brain, the spiritual self has a personality, the spiritual self has feelings, the spiritual self tastes, smells, sees, hears, feels, but not the way we talk about those senses. The soul can't smell. It hasn't got a physical nose. and therefore it can't bridge the spiritual and physical. It doesn't smell like we smell. But you say, but what does Gan Eden smell like? It smells like an orchard or a vineyard. Who's smelling the orchard or the vineyard of the Garden of Eden? The souls are. But when we talk about the smell, of course we're not talking about the physical smell, we're talking about a spiritual smell. What's a spiritual smell? I don't know. It's how do you want me to describe it? Imagine you're all blind. And you were born blind. Rahman al-Hassan, Lolan, may it never happen to anyone that anyone is born blind. But say you were born blind. And I said, Tony, Mr. Blind Man, Tony, explain to Craig the color pink. Tell him about it. Well, from what I understand, pink is very hot. It's warm. It's sensual. It's a vibrant color. But Tony, tell him more. I can't. I've never seen pink. I know about pink, but I've never seen it. So when we talk about the smells of the Garden of Eden, when we talk about the sight of the soul, we're not talking about physical sight. We're not talking about physical smell, but we're using words that we relate to describe something that is a mirror of what goes on in this world. So when we talk about that the soul sees or the soul comprehends, it does, but not in a psychological way, not the way we do. So when a person is having an out-of-body, a near-death experience, this is not their brain operating. This is their higher self operating and experiencing, but not with the organs of experience. Now, it's very important to realize that as long as you are alive and your soul and your body are one, you are only experiencing life as yourself. I'll get there in one sec. Before I get there, I just want to point out, death is the point at which the soul and the body separate. There are many reasons why a soul and body may separate, but I can break it into two primary categories. Number one, a soul may separate from the body because it doesn't want to be in the body anymore. The soul gets exposed to something that draws it beyond the physical realm, and it doesn't return. I'll talk about those concepts shortly. The other option, and therefore the body is left lifeless. So the soul is too big for the body. The other option is that the body is so badly damaged that the soul is not a fit anymore. Someone gets killed. At that moment, the soul and body, killing as opposed to dying is fading out. When someone dies of old age, they're fading away. Their body is breaking down. The soul is losing its desire to energize. It's moving closer to where it knows it's going to be going next, which is a very beautiful space. The body loses the ability to heal itself, and there's a slow breakdown and an easy passing. May we all die from old age. When someone is killed, there's a shock to the body. The soul leaves and hasn't got a body to come back into. Now, you say, I know some people have been in crazy car crashes and they survived, and other people that didn't. I don't know. I'm just telling you different ways that people die. Either the soul leaves or the body doesn't with anchor it. The soul is referred to in spirituality as chelek eloka. Chelek eloka means it's a part of God. God means the infinite. The infinite, not as in the whole universe, but actually the universe is just a minor, micro, simplistic element of the infinite. So if you thought the universe was big, this is bigger. If you thought the universe was incredible, this is more. If you thought the universe had multiple dimensions, this is all dimension. So our soul is a cut of the infinite. Now, why is that important to know? Because we're not independent beings. No one in this room is an independent being. You're not an independent being. I'm not an independent being. You're not an independent being. We're all actually part of the infinite, but we are segmented parts of the infinite that have been placed in our own experience, which I'll talk about in one sec. But in truth, we're all chelek eloka. We're part of the infinite. Which means that if Everything is part of the infinite. All knowledge is part of the infinite. The whole universe is part of the infinite. There's a part of us that's completely in touch with everything else. So imagine you're a computer. So I don't know if you remember life before the internet, but before the internet, anyone that calls it the internet must be from the era of before the internet. Because now it's just, the emphasis isn't on the. If you don't know what I'm talking about, grow young. The internet, before the internet, computers lived in isolation. If you had your Apple IIe or your IBM, it sat on your computer, on your desktop, it was literally this big, and it was there. And no one could hack into it. You couldn't put a credit card into it. You could hardly get a disk into it, let alone a credit card. It was just there. It was just there. Its own independent thing, its only connection to the world was its power source. Nowadays, from my phone or from my computer, I can access the entire universe. The entire universe. What I have at my fingertips on this computer is incredible, absolutely incredible. What I have here, I can go into Wikipedia, or I can go into any website, anywhere. I can connect with people all over the world. I, through my computer, am connected with everything. Well, because there really isn't anything beyond the internet, is there? That's all there is out nowadays. Through Facebook, I can connect with 1.something billion people like that and see what they look like. And I don't get tired meeting all these people. My finger does, but I don't. So the internet is this incredible network, and it's all available. But is all that knowledge in my computer or in my phone? I don't download the whole Wikipedia. I don't download every Google search. I just have access to it. So if I type in the right things into Google, I'll get a whole lot of responses. In under 0.3 of a second, I'll get 6.5 billion responses. I have it. I have access to it, but it doesn't mean I have it. So too, everyone here. Your neshama, your soul, is connected to the internet of the infinite. On one level, you are Google, but on another level, you're just on a computer. You're just a computer, and on another level, you're just a computer user. On one level, we have the computer. It's mine. On another level, the computer is connected to the internet. And on another level, I can access it all. But it requires avoda, it requires work to access, to be the Google. Not to be Google headquarters, to be Google. I don't think it's humanly possible. It actually is, but not via the method of mastering IT. So what are we? I am a computer. I have access to all knowledge, but at my highest point of my soul, I am the knowledge. At that point, we are all the same. We are all at a state of yechidah. We're all at a state of oneness. And when you're one, you are one with everything. When you're one with everything, you are everything. When you are everything, you have all the knowledge. When you have all the knowledge, you are the knowledge. You are not independent. You are everything. So that is the soul. What's the body? The body doesn't need much time. Just feel yourself right now. Just be. That's the body. Who's got a back pain? Who's got a headache? Who's got four toes on one foot? Who's got a broken nail? Who can't taste sweet foods? That's you. That's you. You're a body. You're a sack of bones and blood and muscle and a whole lot of experiences. That's what we are. It doesn't need a too much. But we're a bit more than that. We are also an experience, where we are a thinking. So we are a thinking and we are an experience. And what is reality? What's reality? Who's here right now? Who's in this room right now? Hello? You here? Hello. Good. A few people aren't, but but you're all here. And we all know that everything I've spoken about until now is rather abstract, but finally you're talking bricks and mortar. You're talking about blue and yellow. Hessian and material and computers. Finally, he's talking. I'm back with him. I'm back with him. Exactly. That to a human, this is real. This is real, and everything I've been speaking about is abstract. And to the soul, everything I spoke about is real, and this is abstract. The soul, if the soul could think, the soul would be thinking, you live in a single dimension, in only one time zone at any given point. You don't know what other people are thinking. You don't realize that the world is just dependent on the word. It's just an energy. Oh, how shallow can you get? That's the soul. Like, what are you, crazy? You're living in a prison? That's what our soul is saying to us every single day. Strive for the infinite. Break free of the confine of time and space. And the body is like, what are you, crazy? Next you're going to want me to jump off a cliff to try to see if I can test gravity? This is real. Money is real. We all know, Menachem, we're going to leave this class tonight, and those who have mortgage repayments that they're late on, those will not have gone away. And those who have lots of money, that will not have gone away. Hopefully it hasn't gone away. Those who came in hungry are leaving hungrier. Those who came in full may leave hungry. You can fit. That's real life. That's real life. And that's it. We're living this constant battle. What is real and what is abstract? To the body, the spiritual is abstract. The soul is an abstract to the point that we're not even sure if we have one. And to the soul, the body is abstract and is wondering what the hell is wrong with it. Why doesn't it get on board with enlightenment, with being, with accessing the most incredible things? Our perception of life is defined by our experiences. When someone says, objectively speaking, the fact that they had to move back like this and put their hand out in front means they're not too objective right now. This is a rather subjective position. Objectively speaking, which is code for, in my humble opinion, not that I care for yours, there is no such thing as the objective opinion. Because how can you be objective? We only know what we know. We only know our experiences. We only know what we've learnt. Yes, a wise person will say, I know that I haven't learnt, but you don't know what you haven't learnt. We can't truly be objective. I can't know what you're feeling. Even if I empathize to the moon and back, I can't really empathize with you 100% because I'm not you, nor am I talented enough to tap into my energy, into my soul, which connects me with you. So therefore, I'm left to my subjective experience of life to try to imprint that on myself as you suffer. And then I go, oh, yes, I think I understand your suffering. My whole life is defined by my perceptions, what I see, what I hear, the way I thought I heard it, and the way I thought I saw it. Do you understand that phrase? Who here understands that? That you see things the way you think you saw it, or the way you think. How often do you say to someone or hear people argue and say, no, 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 no. You said, okay, you said is actually code for I heard. If from now on every time you had an argument with someone, they said, no, no, you heard. And we know, because we all know we've been in an argument with one of those stubborn people. And it is. We didn't say that. They heard that.
They're called wives.
I didn't hear that. I heard. Never mind what I heard. But that's our experience. And that then informs our experience. So even everything that just happened here is now a new experience. It's going to frame a new way that we look at men, a new way that we look at women. Our experiences define everything. If someone went through the Holocaust, that will define a lot of the way they look at the world, patterns in the world. If someone didn't go through the Holocaust, that will define how they look at the world. If someone is Jewish, if someone is American, if someone has gone through persecution, if someone has never experienced persecution, if someone grew up wealthy, if someone grew up poor, if someone went to school, if someone didn't go to school, all these things inform the way you understand the world. When you hear phrases like, that politician has lost touch with reality, no, they haven't. They're just experiencing life through their very limited perception and what they're exposed to, and that therefore they've considered that to become normal. We've all lost touch with someone else's reality. I promise you now that every single person here is out of touch with reality, whether the reality is that of an African or of a Middle Easterner, or of someone much wealthier than you, or of a politician, or of a power broker, or of a CEO. We're all out of touch with someone else's reality. The only thing we're in touch with is our experience of reality. And that now allows us to understand the question that hasn't been raised. How is it? I haven't even gone into near-death experiences yet, but how is it that one person sees Jesus, and another person sees a great rabbi, And another person sees, I've never heard anyone say they saw Lenin or Karl Marx. I don't think they have near-death experience. No, there's nothing there. Nothing to look here, hello. Just keep walking. how is it that one person, who's right? The Christian that saw Jesus? They see what they have seen. But what needs to happen is, let's go back. I said that we have our brain, that we have our tongue, we have our ears, but then our soul doesn't. Our soul has its own process. And what the soul sees is normally through our eyes. Separate the soul and body. The soul is experiencing reality and the body is deadish. It's not experiencing anything. The soul comes back in, but it hasn't left. So it hasn't forgotten what it just did, and therefore you need to experience what your soul just saw. But you don't have the brains, the eyes, the wherewithal to understand what your soul is seeing, because that's not you. That's your higher you. And therefore what you need to do is put yourself, you need to process that information, and you process it based on your experiences, based on your beliefs, based on your knowledge, based on your understanding. That is the near-death experience. And that's why one person sees Jesus and another person sees a great rabbi. Because this is what they think they saw. This is what they think they heard. One thing's for sure, they saw something. When people say they saw a light, they haven't seen, it's not like that light, but it's a light nevertheless. When they saw a darkness, it's not like this darkness, but it's a darkness nevertheless. When they saw a person, or when they saw an angel, it's not a Michelangelo or a Raphael or a Leonardo da Vinci. That's not what they saw. But it's not incorrect. They don't say, no, it wasn't that. It's greater than that. And that's because the brain is downloading at a slower pace than the soul is offloading.
Paraphrase that by saying it's like explaining mathematics to a kindergarten class.
Yeah, that's a good metaphor. And that will help us understand Yeshaya, who was one prophet, and Yechezkel, who was another. Yechezkel had the famous prophecy of the chariot. You know, Ezekiel's chariot. And Yeshaya had other prophecies. Yechezkel says it was very noisy. Yeshaya says it was very quiet. Yechezkel saw imagery of animals. Yeshaya saw clarity of light. We're talking about the greatest prophets. Why don't they all see the same thing? And the answer is because one came from a village and one came from a big city. And depending on their experiences of life, their prophecy was defined. That's how much our experiences of life impact our spiritual experience of the soul. So what have we said tonight? Well, the truth is, I feel bad. I knew this would happen, but that's how it is. We've laid out the groundwork. When we talk about the near-death experience next week, we now know what is seeing, we now know what is experiencing, and we also now know why this is happening. Because there is a separation between the guf duck and the guf gus, between the physical self and the ethereal self, which are normally one, but at certain points become two, and then reunite and become one. So what I promise, to do next week is go through all the stages of the near-death experience and explain them and explain what is going on and what is being seen and what is being experienced, not in a subjective way, but purely based on the texts. But I think we now have what it takes to build onto that, which I believe will bring you to a point of no questions. What it'll also do, not no questions because you won't have, you may have questions, but a lot of the klotzkashes, the basic questions, will be taken care of. But what this also does is when we start talking about what's on the other side, which is not next week, but the week after, or what happens after death, well, now we know. We've lived a life, we've had experiences, those are going to come back in 2 weeks to haunt us. Ah, it's going to come back. We're going to talk about that in the post-death experience. And then what's actually on the other side, we're going to leave the whole body behind, and we now understand that the soul is an experience, but it is not an experience like we understand. But it will allow us to have words that allow us to have a glimpse into what the inner self, the higher self, the neshama of us is experiencing. What I'd like to do now is a short meditation, just based on what we've learned tonight. And then we will take any questions as required. So if you want, you can just get comfortable. Is David here? Or Phil? No, just if you could turn the dials. This meditation is short. It's a 5-minute exercise, if anyone wants to know. It's purely just so we can move this learning into a practical space. So just triple check your phones at this point. Important. And just be comfortable in your seat with your hands in your lap, your feet on the ground. When you're comfortable, you can close your eyes. And let's just begin by focusing on our breathing. Is that a phone, out of curiosity? Is that our video camera? It's nice, huh? If you want, just close the screen. I might turn it off. There you go. Okay, so just come back to your breathing. Welcome the silence. And the purpose of this breathing and the feeling yourself in your chair is just to center yourself. What we're going to do in this short exercise is just experience ourselves as a physical self, and then beginning to move into the higher self. So let's begin by doing a body scan. What that means is I want you to focus on the top of your head. So shifting your awareness to the very scalp at the top of your head. And just begin to slowly move your awareness down through your body, feeling each part. Noticing your eyebrows and their position, your nose, your cheeks and jaw. So just moving slowly downwards. Notice any pain, tension, comfort. There may be pains or aches that you haven't really noticed yet today. You're checking in very deliberately with each body part and each organ, feeling them, being with them, having a relationship with them. You'll notice the points of contact between your back and the chair and your bottom and the chair. You'll feel the texture of your clothing where your hands are resting. You may even notice the pulse in your fingers. You'll detect the feet and their point of contact. And so what we're doing here is really feeling our guf, our body, our physical self. And I want you to see if you can slowly recede into yourself. to lose the focus on feelings and senses right now. Notice the sense of being alive. It's somewhere within. So you're alive. Feel alive. So this is generally an awareness that you can find between your head and your stomach. It might be where you call yourself I. And if you're struggling to identify this, just say to yourself, I, and see where you feel the I taking place. Where am I? The I. Self. Self. The I, which can be emotional, that can be intellectual. In fact, it's the I that is a composite of both. It is not your thinking, nor is it your feeling. It's just I. I am higher than my feeling and thinking. It's just there. And so you're just having a momentary experience with yourself and the awareness of self without your physical senses. You're not thinking or feeling it, you're just being it. And this is the gateway. This I is the door into your deeper self. The point at which you begin to connect with things outside of you. With everything. And it's important that we have this awareness of ourselves so that we're not limited to our thinking or feeling. And know that there is a door inside us. It may be closed, but there's a path beyond it. But tonight we're going to keep that door closed. And just know that it's there. Slowly come back to your breathing, point of contact with your chair, the sensation of your feet on the ground. Your hands in your lap. The feeling in your shoulders and neck. And you'll notice that you may have gone somewhere beyond there without leaving. But now as you've become more aware of your physical condition, it's harder to switch back to that I. And perhaps you weren't able to really escape the physical. You couldn't access the I. And that's okay. That's okay. Just spend a bit of time now with your breathing. Realize that in a moment we're going to open our eyes and we're going to be flooded with sensory stimulation. becoming very distracted by the physical space we're in, which will define the time that we exist. And we're here, we're in the room. But we know that there's an I right here within us. The me. But not the ego me, the deep me. When you're ready, just take a few final breaths. When you're comfortable, you can open your eyes. And once you open your eyes, just sit. Just be in your chair. Let's just process what we've gone through tonight. It's a lot of information. Hopefully a worthwhile set of principles and learnings. If tonight was a little academic for you, I apologize. There are three types of movies, kiddie movies, which are 70 minutes. Then older movies, which are closer to 95 minutes, and now movies are a minimum of 2 hours. This series is one of those 3-hour movies. If we did it in 70 minutes, you'd go, that was quick, but when it would be over, you'd say, ah, too short. If it was a 95-minute one, you'd say, could have done with a bit more. But as is true Menachem Wolf style, I've decided to give you the long version and have you leave a little more knowledgeable. And tonight we walk home, go home, realizing there is the me that experiences and is trapped by my experience. That's the physicality of sensory experience. And it's not a bad thing because we live here. And then there's the me that is somewhere deeper beyond that, but right here all the while.